Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and with us from Minnesota is Anton Troyer. He's a professor at Bemidji State University and the author of a number of books. The latest is a young reader's edition of Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. We'll talk with him about some of the questions he's been asked and talk about how important it is to ask. And, of course, we'd love to hear from you. What would you like to know about Indian terminology or history? Join in the conversation. Give a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Anton Troyer, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Oh, thanks for having me on. It's a great pleasure.
Well, you published the original version of this book in 2012. Tell us how this version is different.
You know, when the kind of made-for-adults version came out in 2012, I think it took me and a lot of other folks by surprise, and it really took off. I ended up traveling all over the country and talking directly to a lot of young people and just realized how important it would be to speak directly to them through the book. And also a lot has happened since 2012. We had the Dakota Access Pipeline protest. There was that confrontation at the Lincoln Memorial. There's been a lot going on in our national political and health culture. COVID has had a huge impact in Indigenous communities. And so there was just a whole bunch of content that needed to be added and updated, and I ended up retooling the whole thing, and it's off to a great start. So I'm really excited about it.
Well, I'm excited about it. Excuse me. I'm excited about it, too. I really enjoyed going through it. You know, what did you have to do to make it more accessible to younger readers?
You know, a combination of things. For starters, among the hats that I wear is I'm the father of 9 kids. So I like test drove everything I wrote out on my kids. I'd have them read it out loud, and I could tell when they were laughing or when they were bored, you know, or if vocabulary choice was, you know, not on. But I've also, you know, I've done so much work in recent years with K-12 educators and also directly with students, you know, middle and high school students that, you know, I test drove stuff with them too. And they always had lots of questions, and sometimes the questions would be, you know, a little different than the most common ones that adult audiences would ask, but a lot of them were the same too.
Yeah. I'm wondering about how important is it for you to be neutral in the book, or was it more important to share your opinions?
You know, I think there's no way for anyone to be totally neutral. We all have a perspective, and, you know, even the title itself is kind of tongue in cheek, because there's no way you can get everything you need to know about anything in any one book. And I got a house full of natives, and I don't even know what they're thinking half the time, you know, and I'm one human being, and I'm one person's view and perspective. And sometimes, you know, if somebody, you know, has a question like, who was Eli Parker, or what did the Oneida do when, you know, George Washington was crossing the Delaware? That's pretty easy and objective. When somebody asks, well, what do you think about mascots, or what do you think about the Dakota Access Pipeline protest? I think anyone, no matter where they are on the political spectrum, you know, even a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio is going to have a hard time giving a perfectly balanced representation of all of the nuances. So I'm just upfront about, you know, who I am, where I'm coming from, and really encourage people to seek multiple perspectives.
Yeah, you know, it can be uncomfortable for non-natives to ask these kinds of questions that you pose in the book. Why is it not only okay, but really a good idea?
Well, for starters, we're going to have to figure out how to get along as human beings. You know, right now, the majority of the K-12 students in America are either Black, Indigenous, or other people of color. that's who's here. And it kind of doesn't matter, you know, on the political side, Democrats, Republicans, build wall, don't build a wall. That's who's here. And we're going to have to figure out how to get along, how to understand one another, how to build and run this incredible country together. And to do that, we need to understand one another. We need to relate to multiple perspectives. You know, if I held up one index finger, you know, and said, what is that? Well, one person might tell me that it's, you know, the number one, and someone else might say, oh, you know, that means up. And someone else will say, no, that's a finger. And of course they're all right. It's just a matter of perspective. And so when we can see something like that as all the many different things that it can be, it's easier to navigate. And it's probably good advice if you ever want to, like, you know, be in a marriage or have a kid or work in a place that has more than two employees. But certainly in our current social climate, it's more important than ever to seek out and understand one another.
And I'm sure there are situations where there may be questions that seem invasive or maybe certainly uninformed. How do you recommend natives answer questions that may seem that way?
You know, first of all, I think most of us in America kind of went to school and got a sugar-coated version of Chris Columbus in the first Thanksgiving. In fact, you know, that was my experience as a Native person. Like, I knew what it was like living in my body with a brown skin and a, you know, and a couple of braids. But, and so I could speak to that, but my mother ended up becoming the first female Native attorney in the state of Minnesota. And by the time I finished high school, I would have really struggled to explain tribal sovereignty to anyone. And I think it's through no fault of our own that most of us haven't had a lot of great access to information. And as a result, I think a couple of things happen. One is we all have gaps in what we know. And I sometimes do work with a school district, you know, some of them might have 58 different languages spoken in the school district by the students, you know, like Portland Public Schools is exactly like that. You know, no one's going to be the content expert on every single one of them. And we all have to teach who shows up. At the same time, we have to be careful that the absent narratives don't scream at the kids that, you know, you and yours aren't important and aren't relevant and don't matter. So we have to look for the information. And I think, you know, as an Indigenous person, you know, sure, there are frustrations with, you know, the pace of learning and change. But at the same time, I fundamentally believe, like, most human beings are trying the best that they can. And, you know, because none of us got it handed on a silver platter, we should show up and try to give a meaningful answer instead of an angry rebuke, and build bridges. And ultimately, you know, when we form genuine relationships and friendships and connections and build that bridge, it, you know, it's pretty fatal to prejudice and misunderstanding.
Yeah. Anton Troyer, our guest today, professor at Bemidji State University, and his latest book is Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take some calls. Eugene in Viola, we'll go to you first. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning, Larry. I spent 5 years Rosebud Indian Reservation from 1975 to 1980 teaching junior high math. And one of the things I discovered out there, in the white societies we know it, we are a competitive society. We will compete with each other in the classroom. The Lakota will not do that. They are a cooperative society. They will not compete with each other in the classroom and raise their hands, so you had to do it individually with each student.
Comment on that, Anton?
Sure. So I would say really a couple things. So first of all, Within indigenous communities, there are 574 federally recognized tribes. There's a lot of us. And within that, we have a whole variety of languages, cultures, perspectives, and ways of doing things. So not all Native people are going to think and act the same way. But your caller is right about something in that I think as a general practice within mainstream American culture, we are very competitive. Like, how many board games or sports do we have where nobody wins and nobody loses? You know, yoga. Yeah. They'll probably have yoga competitions soon, you know. But within indigenous communities, sometimes there is this messaging. I know this is the case in my community, you know, and many others, that, you know, you're one of your greatest values and assets as a member of the community is not your ability to outdo everyone, but your ability to contribute to the broader group. You know, like a successful hunter will give away their kill rather than hoard it all for themselves. And it's a way of showing respect and caretaking. And you actually get more, you know, props and respect for doing that. And it is something that shows up in the classroom sometimes too, where, you know, I had a kid, one of my own sons, who, you know, he could sit still in a deer stand for 5 hours in a row, but he couldn't sit still in a desk for 5 minutes without something going wrong, you know? And when they were trying to figure out how do we connect with this kid, you know, the toolboxes were things like, you know, gold sticker charts. Every time he's good, he gets a sticker. And then once he gets enough, he can get a treat out of the treat box and that kind of stuff. And I said, yeah. I love you guys, and I understand what you're trying to do, but these are rewards and punishments built around competing with other people for more stickers and, you know, outdoing other people and showing your individual accomplishments. And in some ways, it's kind of like materialism, having more than others. And he's unmotivated by that, but he's highly motivated by relationships. And so if we can work on building the relationships, you should see how he shows up for his family or what he does, like when he's, you know, has a deer kill and he runs around and fills up everybody's freezer. And in the end, they listened and he ended up graduating from high school and he was a high performer and, you know, went on to be a load-bearing citizen and everything was fine. But we had to speak to him in his cultural language.
Oh. Eugene, thank you again for calling. Let's give Sheila in Waukesha a chance to join in now. Sheila, hello.
Hi, Larry, and hi, Dr. Troyer. I've been interested for most of my life in place names, especially, you know, Native American place names in Wisconsin and things, and the specific clan totems within the nations. And I was studying up around Lake Winnebago and found that there was a clan up there whose totem was the merman. And I guess I was just wondering if you knew any sort of history behind why they might have chosen a merman instead of a more local Wisconsin animal, and if it's somehow related to, like, the water spirit snake sort of creature. That's it.
Yeah, happy to take that one. So, first of all, you know, a place like Wisconsin, a huge percentage of the place names do come from indigenous languages, you know, words like Milwaukee and Waukesha. So, you know, just exploring that and learning about that can really say a lot about what indigenous people saw and how they related to places, because a lot of those transferred as early European explorers were talking to Native people. And they said, well, what's this place? And what's over on the other side of the hill? And they were getting indigenous explanations and names. So when we unpack that, we can learn a lot about the places that all of us are calling home now. With regard to the clans, so first of all, in Wisconsin, there are many different tribes. So there are 11 federally recognized tribes in Wisconsin. And some, you know, like within the Ojibwe group, there's more than one Ojibwe reservation, but there are other tribes with different languages and cultural customs too. You know, Menominee is different from Ho-Chunk, which is also known as Winnebago, you know, is different from Oneida and so forth. So all of the Wisconsin tribes do have clan systems, but they're a little different from one another. So, for example, I can tell you, you know, with your specific question about the, you know, the Mer people in Ojibwe folklore and culture, that's not something that was like borrowed from the Little Mermaid. That's an ancient thing. So like even William Warren, who's doing oral history with, you know, elders in Wisconsin and Minnesota, documented in the 1800s Ojibwe people saying, yep, I'm from the Mer clan. And, you know, here's a story behind our, you know, our group. So that is something ancient and indigenous rather than imported. That said, you know, there's a lot more to say about clans. Like we could spend our whole radio show just talking about them. But Ojibwe people and actually the other Wisconsin groups too, Oneida, Ho-Chunk, and so forth, the clans are actually a birthright. So people don't pick their own clan. It's something that's just an inheritance. When you're born into it. And it works a little different than like, you know, Scottish clans, like the O'Hanlon clan, which is like a family grouping and everyone living in the same village was from that clan. For the Wisconsin tribes, usually there's a taboo against marrying someone from the same clan. So every village would have more than one clan represented. And they're kind of like, you know, sigil for your house, but also a spiritual guide. For the Oneida, they're important in structuring, you know, their longhouse, social and ceremonial things, and so forth. So, yeah, still a vibrant part of indigenous cultures.
Sheila, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Anton Troyer, our guest today, professor at Bemidji State University and author of Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. And I hope you'll join in and ask your own questions or make some comments. Number 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Talking today with Anton Troyer. His latest book is a young reader's edition of Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians, But Were Afraid to Ask. Again, join in 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Rick in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Rick. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I was just wondering if Dr. Troyer, Anton, could address the entomology of Wisconsin. I just think that everybody in Wisconsin would like to hear his opinion on the entomology of Wisconsin.
Yeah, thanks for the question. Yeah, even the name for the great state of Wisconsin comes from an indigenous language. So in a way, Wishkunsing would be the word, and you could even translate it as sweet land, but it's a reference to the great hardwoods of Wisconsin and the maple sugar production that indigenous people engaged in there. So even Wisconsin speaks to the resources and indigenous connection to the land.
Yeah, it does indeed. Rick, thank you. Jim in Newport Township, Illinois. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Yes, I called to make the comment that I question the popularity of the phrase Native American, even though I must admit when I first heard it, it seemed to have a nice, pleasing ring to it. Because, in fact, the human species is not native to the Western Hemisphere. I think a much more appropriate word to use would be Aboriginal, which means original or first. But, like, for instance, in Canada, they don't use the phrase native. But I think it's an indication of the political direction of our country rather than anything that is factual or accurate.
Yeah, appreciate the comment. I can tell you this, we're getting pulled in every direction on terminology. You could even have, you know, a dozen Native people, and they won't agree about what terms we should use. And there's actually a pretty good case for and against most of them. I would love to see us do what we've, you know, what happened in Canada. They actually have, you know, through an assembly of their political leaders for the Indigenous communities, you know, a process for like shared political conversation and action. And they just said, we're going to dispense with the term reserve, which is what they were using instead of reservation. And we will also dispense with the words Indian and Aboriginal. And we're just going to call the places First Nations. And we're going to call the Indigenous people there First Nations people. And I guess what was kind of nice about it was everyone kind of got into agreement, just a couple of syllables. It speaks to that, you know, originality, you know, indigeneity is specific. Everyone knows who you're talking about and so forth. So that was pretty nice. Here in the U.S., we just haven't gotten agreement. And there's even a broader array of labels, you know, like, oh, well, the Black community's kind of gone round and around too. Should it be Black or African-American? How do we find a more inclusive one? You can't use colored people, but people of color. And so there isn't universal agreement. And I think your caller's right that there are drawbacks to Native or Native American too, because if you say a Milwaukee Native, is that a Native American person from Milwaukee or just someone born and bred? And so you end up having to use a bunch of syllables to clarify that. Indigenous is nice and, you know, is winning out in some circles too, but I mean, all humans are indigenous to somewhere. So you end up having to use more words and say North American Indigenous, you know? And even words like American Indian are still hanging on, even though Chris Columbus got lost and thought he was in China or Japan or India. Yes, and these are Indians, and the word stuck. And part of that is a political thing. Like the U.S. government has a formal like trust responsibility to Indigenous communities that are federally recognized by the government, and they call them American Indian people. It's a political designation as those who are enrolled members of federally recognized tribes. And so even some of the groups like American Indian Movement have said, well, we're going to use this label that was used to oppress us to liberate us. And they've kind of hung on. It can be very confusing for everybody else. Like, well, what do we do then? And so, you know, for me, I would love for us to get to First Nation, Native Nation, something like that. But in between, you know, I tend to use most of those words somewhat interchangeably, aware of their shortcomings as a means of making safe space, but not as a way to be careless about, you know, what words matter. If you happen to be working for a school or a program, you know, or a company, and this is a question like, what should we use for our communications and so forth, it usually comes up. And what I usually recommend people do is speak to their Indigenous stakeholders. So like if it's a school, speak to your, you know, Native American parent committee and say, what do you want us to do? And you'll get two benefits. And one of them is you'll be responsive to your local Native community and authentic. And then if anyone gives you a hard time about your label choice, you can say, well, we are following the direction of our Native stakeholders. We revisit our terminology discussion on a regular basis. And we'll bring your comments to that discussion and make sure that they're aired out. And it gets you get out of getting beat up around the ears card and keeps you connected to your Native community.
That's a great comment. Jim, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Cassandra in Beloit, let's go to you. Hi, Cassandra.
Well, hello, Larry and Professor. I am not Native, but I had the privilege of being an educator in Alaska. And to prepare to be a teacher in Alaska, at least in the interior where I taught, you were required to take really demanding courses at the university about Indigenous languages and practices. My professor is deceased now, but he was the first UPIC to receive a PhD, and he was Oscar Quagley. And he put us through a very disciplined course of studies. Sadly, when I did become an educator in Alaska, I did not see many of my colleagues reflecting the knowledge that came from those courses. So I later then became a negotiator for teachers' contracts. And I worked particularly in a city called Tok about 12 years ago, which is on the Alcan border. I had one Native person on the negotiating team, and I have to tell you that she was a negotiator's dream because she understood so deeply the power of consensus, and she had the skill to manipulate. And I don't mean that in a negative sense, because she was so gentle in the way she did it, but to influence the rest of the negotiating team to help us all to understand the power of consensus. And at the end of that contract, we got the longest potlatch leave in the history of Tok, which was a leave. Potlatches are used also for grieving. And it was used for the grieving of elders who honored that potlatch tradition. So I wanted to share that because the Alaska Natives have quite a different background from many of the indigenous people in the rest of the United States.
Right.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Comment, Anton.
Yeah, so I mean, there are actually a whole bunch of things popping up for me on that one. It's a great comment. So one is that, you know, the legal status and the cultural landscape in Alaska is significantly different than in the rest of the United States with regard to, you know, federally recognized tribes and so forth. And, you know, Alaska became a state after, you know, most of the, after the entire treaty period and after most of the legal precedents and so forth had already been set. So they've, you know, among other things, had established a system of what they call corporations that kind of govern natural resource access and use. And there are plenty of problems with that too, but it's just a different structure. And it is true that the state of Alaska has a whole separate set of Alaskan native language and culture standards that kind of run parallel to the regular state educational standards. So some things are pretty interesting there. In a place like Wisconsin, I think, you know, by inference, your caller is right to point out that there's a lot of room to grow. Everybody's knowledge and engagement with Native people and topics. So in the state of Wisconsin, there is some legislation called Act 31 that was passed after the or in response to the treaty protests going on in the late 1980s and early 1990s. And it just requires Wisconsin K-12 educators to have a class in Indigenous something. And it is honored, and some of the resources developed are really useful. But, I mean, you can just kind of do the minimum getting through a class or a, you know, training and not get a ton out of it, too. So I think it'd be really helpful to scale that up and provide more resources and more training and put it right in the middle. I think one of the things we just bump up against is that in this day and age, everything's become politicized and there is pushback and resistance to the idea of, you know, doing more to elevate the stories and awareness and histories of often marginalized groups. And so it sometimes turns into a bit of a political fight. But, you know, my response to that would simply be, you know, if you look at 100 years ago when the women's suffrage movement was coming to its climax, there were a lot of men who were just terrified that if women got the right to vote, it would somehow take something away from men and that it would marginalize the stories of men and so forth. And it's almost comical to think about it now, or at least ridiculous, because only 17% of the world's leaders are, you know, political leaders are women, and patriarchy is still alive and well. And when women got the vote and entered the workforce, the stock market went up and men owned most of the stocks. You know, in hindsight, we can see that women rising, you know, didn't make men diminish and get less. And so today there's a little fear amongst some people that if people of color rise and, you know, penetrate academia and books and, you know, culture, public culture and politics, that it's somehow going to diminish or take things away or erase white people and whiteness. And I don't think that's a legitimate fear. If people of color do better, it just means there are more people who are, you know, load-bearing citizens paying taxes rather than drains on the government or something. And it means everyone's more fully humanized. So I think ultimately, you know, even when your neighbor's house value goes up, yours does too. So we all do better when we all do better.
Yeah, it's well, very well put. Cassandra, thank you. John in Madison, we'll turn to you. Hi, John.
Yeah, hey. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to, you know, give a shout out from, you know, the Afro Boricuas and the indigenous people in the Caribbean who are still out there, who I feel like kind of, you know, as the people who had first encounters sometimes don't get as much notoriety or acknowledgement, and speak to, you know, how I feel like here in Wisconsin, having family members who are in the Ho-Chunk or on Ojibwe tribes tend to have like a blood level that they will count you toward or for, you know. And I just kind of wanted to point out that I feel like identity is kind of like really hard. I feel like, you know, when you're a part of this group of people who have been marginalized for so long, and just kind of, you know, want to speak to like my own roots and being Taino and the people, you know, the culture of like the matriarchal society. I mean, our major god is a female, and kind of just, you know, you couldn't do anything without, you know, a female involvement, whether that be government or hunting or, you know, whatever it is, women were always involved. And I just wanted to say that, you know, we can reach peace. We've seen it. We've had 1,000-year peace in our island. So I just want to say thank you for talking about this, and I'll take my comment off.
John, thank you so much. Anton, comment.
Yeah, so a couple things. So one is, I think your caller is spot on that identity is complex. Like even when we talk about race in America, sometimes we mean very different things. So I would say that first of all, race is partially about color. There's no way around that. But it's also partially about culture, and it's also partially about consciousness and how we see ourselves. So for example, you could take, you know, a Black Dominican who speaks Spanish, a Black Haitian who speaks French Creole, and an African American who speaks English, and they're all going to get racially profiled the same way. But yeah, when they all start talking to each other, you know, the Black Dominican might have more affinity with a Spanish speaker who looks white or brown. And a lot of us are increasingly multiracial. So, you know, how we see ourselves makes a big difference too. Like even, you know, across the state of Wisconsin, coming through the doors of our schools, you know, you may have students who identify very strongly as indigenous who might look Black, look white, or look brown, or look racially ambiguous, but still, you know, are engaged with their culture or have a very strong identity in who they are as Native people. And so I think it's important to be aware of the nuances and complexities to identity. And in addition to that, there's a further complicating variable, you know, for the federally recognized tribes in the United States, which your caller was alluding to, which is the issue of tribal enrollment, where, you know, all of the tribes in Wisconsin have had, at least at some point in time, a requirement of a certain percentage of blood, you know, from an original, you know, ancestor on the tribal rolls to be eligible for citizenship in that native nation. And it's sometimes been difficult for people who identify in terms of consciousness and culture, and may even look the part, you know, a stereotypical part of being a Native person, but aren't eligible for enrollment because of messed up records. Or you could have, you know, four grandparents each from a different tribe in Wisconsin, and the kid might not, you know, the children that they have with somebody outside of the group might not be eligible for enrollment at all because they only count from a certain group. So that's a contested issue that's being discussed and debated within Indigenous communities. And some of the tribes, you know, like Red Cliff, for example, has changed the criteria to make it easier for people to be enrolled and start dispensing with blood quantum. Others like the St. Croix Ojibwe actually increased it to a 1/2. And so it's, you know, it's divisive for, and different people have different views. So for myself, I think we should dispense with all the eugenics Nazi science and pick some Indigenous criteria for who should be a citizen. But not everybody agrees with me.
John, thank you again for your comments and your question. Well, Anton, I expect this book is going to do very well. How's it doing?
Oh, I
so
sure
far?
Hope so. You know, it just released on April 6th, and I think it's off to a great start. I think they sold out the first print run, and they're printing more books, and it's doing well. It's available everywhere, you know, like Amazon and things like that. But we have special relationship-dependent booksellers. It's been kind of interesting, you know, when COVID hit, everybody was stuck at home. And some of the independent booksellers like Birchbark Books in Minneapolis, you know, we did our book launch event there. They're actually at the point now where they're selling more books online and through, you know, mailing them out than they were before with people coming into the store. So there have been some silver linings around the COVID cloud, too, as everyone's adjusting how we go about the business.
Well, I have to tell you, I really enjoyed your book very much. You have another one coming out, when, in fall or something?
I do, yeah. I've got a book called The Cultural Toolbox that'll be out in October. Kind of, you know, a little bit more personal book that's explaining about how my family lives Ojibwe culture in the modern world. I kind of feel like we are ancient and modern all at the same time. We're thousands of years of human history that's still in the making. And how can we use our, you know, we have freedom to change over time, but how can we apply our cultural toolbox in this modern world? So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that one when it comes out, too. It's in
well,
the
I hope we have...
you know, it takes a while to get to release time.
Well, I hope we have it. I hope you'll come back and talk with us about that book as well, Anton. It's always such a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Likewise. Thank you.
Anton Troyer, our guest professor at Bemidji State University, and his latest book is Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. He's got some other great books out there. I interviewed him about an earlier book he wrote, The Language Warrior's Manifesto was the main title of it, and it too is a wonderful book. So great to have him with us, and at this point we're going to switch gears a little bit or a lot and talk with you about the role of vegetables on our plates. It's changed a lot in the last 40 years, and our next guest has some thoughts on that. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.